Well, I don't need to tell you that trumpet sound is Miles Davis. But do you know the tune? That slow, cool, heartbroken melody, and it doesn't announce itself, it just appears. And it spirals up and then it dissolves before it quite resolves. What's it called? It's called Stella by Starlight. That's today's Standard Show. Today we're going deep into one of the most loved and maybe argued about jazz standards ever written. A song that began life in a ghost story. A melody born in Hollywood and reborn again and again in the hands of bebop giants. Cool jazz visionaries and singers who could bend it to fit just about any emotional truth they needed to tell. Stella by Starlight ranks 10 on jazzstandard.com's list of the most performed standards. It sits in volume 1 of The Real Book, the unofficial Bible of jazz musicians everywhere, and it has been recorded by everyone from Charlie Parker to Ella Fitzgerald, from Sinatra to Robert Glasper. It is, by any measure, a must-know tune, but it's kind of a difficult tune. Harmonically, it does things that other standards don't do. It refuses to stay in just one key. It defies your expectations at almost every turn. And as we'll discover, the version of the song that most musicians have been playing for the last 50 years may not be exactly what the composer wrote. That's the thing about jazz standards. They live and breathe. They belong to everyone who plays them, and nobody really owns them. Except, well, legally, somebody does. And that story's worth telling, too. I'm Joanna Lean, and welcome to The Standard. Now, let's go find Stella. Something you may not know, Stella by Starlight was written for a haunted house. It's 1944. Paramount Pictures was releasing a supernatural thriller called The Uninvited, directed by Lewis Allen and starring Ray Milland and Gail Russell. The film was considered one of the best ghost stories Hollywood had yet put on screen. The story of a composer and his sister who buy a beautiful cliffside mansion in England, only to discover its history of tragedy and its rather active haunting. Paramount brought in Victor Young to write the score. This was not a surprising choice. Victor Young was, by 1944, one of the most celebrated film composers in Hollywood. He had 22 Oscar nominations to his name, though in one of the more heartbreaking stories in music history, he wouldn't leave to receive his only win. He was reliable, prolific, and enormously gifted with melody. For The Uninvited that was, to put it plainly, gorgeous. It drifted through the film's underscore like smoke. It's romantic, slightly ominous, beautiful in a way that made you uneasy. And at a pivotal moment in the film, Ray Milland's character Rick sits at the piano and plays it for Stella, played by Gail Russell, and tells her he's composed a serenade to Stella by starlight. That's where the name comes from. It's not a poem or a lyric. It's a line of dialogue in a ghost movie. That's Victor Young and his orchestra. That's the composer himself playing Stella by Starlight. So you can trust those changes. That's how it was intended to sound. Victor Young's life story is itself almost as strange as any ghost story. He was born in Chicago on August 8th, 1899, into a Jewish musical family. His father was a tenor with a touring opera company. When Victor's mother died and his father abandoned the family, young Victor, who had been playing violin since age 6, was sent to live in Poland with his grandfather. He studied at the Warsaw Imperial Conservatory under the Polish composer Roman Stutkowski. By his teens, he was performing as a concert violinist with the Warsaw Philharmonic, and he even played at a concert attended by Tsar Nicholas II. Then World War II intervened. Young spent months interned in a Russian prison facility. He escaped, and details of how remain murky, and eventually made his way back to the United States by 1920. He was 20 years old, had survived war and imprisonment, and arrived in America with world-class musical training and an absolute gift for melody. He worked first as a violinist, then as an arranger for radio and theater. One story from this period says it's all about his musical instinct. In 1930, band leader Isham Jones asked Young to arrange Hoagie Carmichael's Stardust, which had been played up to that point as an up-tempo number. Young slowed it down. He played the melody as a sweeping, romantic violin solo. That transformation inspired lyricist Mitchell Parrish to write the words we now know, and Stardust became one of the most recorded songs in American history. That's Victor Young's genius in a nutshell. He understands that a melody's power lives in its patience. By the mid-1930s, Young had moved to Hollywood, where Paramount signed him as their chief composer. Over the next two decades, he scored more than 300 films. He could work in any style, the Irish romanticism of John Ford's The Quiet Man, the Spanish drama For Whom the Bell Tolls, the biblical epic of Samson and Delilah. Colleagues marveled at his speed and his almost supernatural facility with tune. His motto was, writing a movie star is like a boy sitting in a balcony with a girl. He must be forceful enough to impress the girl, but not loud enough to attract the usher. From his films came some of the most durable songs in the American songbook. When I Fall in Love, Love Letters, My Foolish Heart, Golden Earrings, and of course, Stella by Starlight. Here's another ballad written by Victor Young. I don't need any more excuses to play Carmen McRae, who I really love. This version of When I Fall in Love is from an album called Book of Ballads by Carmen McRae from 1959.
When I fall in love, it will be forever. Or I'll never fall in love. In a restless world like this is, love is ended before it's begun, and too many moonlight kisses seem to cool in the warmth of the sun. When I give my heart, it will be completely, or I'll never give my heart. And the moment that I feel that you feel that way too, is when I'll fall in love with you. When I give my heart, it will be forever, or I'll never, 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 never give my. And the moment that I feel that you feel the same way too, is when I'll give my. When I give my heart to you.
Victor Young died on November 10th, 1956, in Palm Springs of a cerebral hemorrhage. He was only 57. His Oscar for Around the World in 80 Days was awarded posthumously the following year. He never knew he'd won it. Stella, at least he knew, was special. The melody he wrote for A Haunted House was too beautiful to stay in a ghost story. You're listening to The Standard Show on Biggie Radio from Edmonton, Alberta, Canada, and I'm your host, Johanna Aline, with today's standard, Stella by Starlight. 2 years after The Uninvited premiered, Victor Young sent the theme to his longtime collaborator, Ned Washington, and said, "Put words to this." Washington had a problem immediately. The song already had a title, which is Stella by Starlight, and that title was going to have to appear somewhere in the lyrics. And Washington's solution is a bit unusual. Rather than opening or closing the song with the title phrase, as most standards do, it's buried in the middle. It's about three quarters of the way through. The song doesn't open with its own name, but it starts with an evocative image. That great symphonic theme. It's one of the few standards in the canon where the title sneaks up on you. By the time you reach it, the melody has already pulled you in, and the title arrives only as a confirmation of something you can already feel in the song rather than an announcement. But I think that's why it always takes me a second to figure out what song this is, right? You hear the whole theme and you have to kind of hum along in your head until you get to the part that says, "That's Stella by Starlight," right? Ned Washington was born Edward Michael Washington in Scranton, Pennsylvania on August 15, 1901. He started in vaudeville as a master of ceremonies, a man who could connect with any audience, he could sell any act, make any room feel warm. And that skill never leaves his writing. His lyrics are always direct without being simple, emotional without being too manipulative. He wrote the words for Jiminy Crickets, "When You Wish Upon a Star," in Disney's Pinocchio in 1940. That song won him his first Academy Award. He wrote the theme to High Noon, which is "Do Not Forsake Me, Oh My Darling," for a second Oscar in 1952. He wrote "The Nearness of You" with Hoagy Carmichael, "I'm Getting Sentimental Over You" with Tommy Dorsey, and the theme to Rawhide. He was nominated 12 times for the Academy Award. He is, in short, one of the greatest lyric writers of the 20th century. What he brought to Stella by Starlight is restraint. The lyrics don't explain too much. They evoke a feeling of late night, sky, love, and then you step back and let the melody do the rest. Listen to Ella Fitzgerald sing the bridge, and you'll understand exactly what Washington was doing. He was writing a frame, not making a painting. Here's Ella Fitzgerald from 1961 with Stella by Starlight.
The murmur of a brook at eventide that ripples by a nook where two lovers hide. A great symphonic flame that's Stella by Starlight. Have you seen Stella?
The lyric Washington wrote has been, over the decades, somewhat subordinate to the melody. Most jazz musicians play Stella as an instrumental. When singers perform it, they often take tremendous liberties, but the lyric is never forgotten. And what's worth noting, that whoever plays the tune instrumentally is, in some sense, always humming those words underneath. My heart and I agree, she's everything on earth to me. Washington delivered the lyric to Famous Music Corporation, which published the song commercially in 1946, and then the world got a hold of it. Listening to the first popular recording of Stella by Starlight, it's a big band instrumental by Harry James and his orchestra, released in May of 1947. It reached number 21 on the pop charts. 2 months later, Frank Sinatra recorded a vocal version with Axel Stordahl's orchestra, and that version also reached number 21. In the pop world of 1947, that was a hit. What's interesting about those early pop recordings is that they treated the song as a lush romantic ballad, which it kind of is, while smoothing over the harmonic complexity that would later drive jazz musicians absolutely wild. The more musicians studied this song, the more they realized this thing is strange. Beautiful, but strange. Most jazz musicians transpose it to B-flat major. It's better for the horns, easier to navigate on a lot of instruments. Stan Getz famously recorded it in G. The Real Book put it in B-flat, and that's become the default, which, as we'll discover later, created its own set of complications. Jazz recording came in January 22nd of 1952. Charlie Parker walked into Reeves Studios in New York City and recorded 4 tracks in one session, all with a large studio orchestra arranged and conducted by Joe Lipman. One of those tracks was Stella by Starlight. Parker's tone on this session is notably warm, less sharp and percussive than some of his bop recordings. It's a bit more settled and more luxurious. The orchestral arrangement opens with 3 slash and eighth note downbeats and then settles into strings and brass coloring the melody. Parker's solo just soars over this lush backdrop, and then, in a detail that has delighted Parker scholars ever since, there's a moment where Bird was supposed to drop out, and he just doesn't. He just keeps going. A brief, barely audible run-on. Whether it's an accident or deliberate nonchalance is anyone's guess, it stayed in the final take. The Verve recording confirmed that Stella by Starlight belonged in the jazz world, but the recording that would truly define how jazz musicians would understand and play the song for generations was still 6 years away. In the room, Miles Davis on trumpet, Coltrane on tenor sax, Cannonball Adderley on the alto, Bill Evans piano, Paul Chambers on bass, and Jimmy Cobbs on the drums. This sextet was in the middle of a period of transition that would change jazz permanently. Miles was moving away from dense chord changes of bebop towards something more spacious and more modal, something he would fully articulate in the following year on Kinda Blue. He was, in 1958, a man in the middle of becoming. Mm-hmm. Bill Evans, at the beginning of this recording, is its own seminar. He doesn't play the chords that you expect, and he doesn't resolve anything. He lets the open bars just hang in the air, sparse and delicate. It's as if the chord isn't yet decided. That's why it hits so hard when Miles enters with that muted trumpet. And now he's kind of a parody of restraint, because you know he knows that's his sound. The real book version of Stella by Starlight opens with an E minor 7 flat 5 to A7, what musicians called a half-diminished chord resolving to a dominant. But what you hear in Victor Young's original score, and what Peter Bernstein and Barry Harris would later point out, is that the original first chord is a B-flat diminished chord. The real book opened the song with a substitution, a reharmonization, a modernization. The Miles Davis session effectively canonized that approach. The real book transcription, by most accounts, is based on Miles's changes. Coltrane's solo early on this recording is, as one critic noticed, just startling. A little jagged after Evans' delicate intro, like walking out of a quiet library into bright sunlight. Evans' own piano solo is lush and laconic, as one writer described it, suggesting that the bittersweet spell would be cast over the kind of blues sessions in the following year. This performance was released as part of the album Jazz Track, also known as 1958 Miles, which Columbia would reissue in 1991 as 58 Sessions featuring Stella by Starlight. The very fact that Columbia named the reissue after this track tells you something about what it meant to the music. Miles would continue to perform Stella by Starlight live into the 60s. A 1963 live recording from his quartet with George Coleman, Herbie Hancock, Ron Carter, and Tony Williams is considered by many to be the definitive ballad version of the song. Where the 1958 recording is kind of cool and considered, the 1963 performances are a bit more emotionally direct. Miles knew what this melody was really for. Heard two recordings from 1958 and late 1958 from the Miles Davis First Quartet. I'm going to put a version from 1963 up on the website, which is www.thestandard.com, where you'll hear Miles Davis' second great quartet play the tune, and you can see how far he goes over a career in his interpretation of the song. And that's really what makes a standard, that ability to go back to it and make it fresh and make it new to you and the listener over and over. Stella by Starlight has been recorded hundreds of times across every conceivable style and instrumentation. What follows is not a ranking. There's no such thing as a ranking, but recordings that I think just show you how wide the song's reach has become.
The song a robin sings through years of endless springs, the murmur of a brook at eventide that ripples by a nook where two lovers hide. A great symphonic theme that stellar by starlight and not a dream. My and I agree, she's everything on earth to me.
That was Frank Sinatra from 1962. He'd been recording for 25 years. He had nothing left to prove. His version of Stella, recorded with Count Basie's orchestra for Sinatra Basie, is swing at its most relaxed. Sinatra phrases the lyric with the ease of a man telling a story he's told many times, but he's not tired of. Each word is so precise as a card on a table, nothing rushed, nothing wasted. The Basie band swings underneath with that Kansas City looseness. It's one of the great vocal recordings of the era, and it reminded mainstream audiences that this was still ultimately a song about a person. And then Chet Baker recording Stella at a medium up-tempo swing with his sextet in 1954. What's remarkable about this version is that it's a combination of vulnerability and confidence. His trumpet tone is famously fragile. That light, breathy, personal, playing for one person in a quiet room. But the tempo is brisk, and the song becomes a vehicle for quiet introspection at a really fast pace. And that sounds contradictory, but Baker's hands are absolutely convincing. He was 24 years old and already sounded like a man who'd seen too much and forgotten quite a bit of it. Thank you. That's Chet Baker from 1954, Russ Freeman on the piano, Bob Brockmeyer on valve trombone, Shelley Main on drums, Bud Shank baritone saxophone, Carson Smith bass, and Larry Bunker on the drums. It's from an album that's called The Chet Baker Sextet. You're listening to The Standard Show on Big E Radio from Edmonton, Alberta, Canada, and I'm your host, Joanna Aline. I put together the show, and every week we pick one standard from the Real Book, and we go through it, its history, the context, who's played it, and who's played it best. I'd love to hear what you think of what I've played, and if I've played it best, you can always send me an email. My email address is host@the-standard-show.com. And you can also head to the website and you can see what we've done in the past. You can see what next week's show is, and you can take a look at my merchandise and find some charts that you can play along with as well. This is a live recording of the Keith Jarrett Trio from 2010. The Keith Jarrett Trio is Keith Jarrett on the piano, bassist Gary Peacock, and drummer Jack DeJohnette. And they toured for about 30 years. It's one of the most celebrated partnerships in jazz history. They formed in 1983 and recorded almost exclusively for ECM Records. The trio had built its reputation on a deceptively simple premise. You take the Great American Songbook and you approach all the songs like they've never been played before. Since 1991, the trio had recorded only live performances, and by 2010, their concert appearances were amongst the most sought-after tickets in jazz. That year, they toured extensively, with performances at Place des Arts in Montreal in July, followed by a return to the Montreux Jazz Festival, their first appearance there since 2002, and dates in Seoul, Juan-les-Pins, and across North America and Europe. What makes these live shows really extraordinary is the degree of real-time listening and risk-taking that you have between the trio. It's really live music at its very best. You have three people listening intently to every nuance of the material and their fellow players. The conversations is the music. Jarrett's gospel-tinged vamps, Peacock's fluid commentary in the bass, and DeJohnette's intricate shape-shifting propulsion created an improvisational language entirely their own. No set lists, no fixed arrangements. Each night was a one-time event, which is exactly why audiences follow them from city to city. Thank you. Robert Glasper is perhaps the best argument that Stella by Starlight will survive into whatever jazz evolves into next. His live version at Capitol Studios is a lush, moody, and full of harmonic freedom. A jazz piano vocabulary filtered through gospel and R&B, very much a 21st century ambiance, which makes the tune feel fresh again. He keeps the essential melody intact, but goes around all the spaces that are left by those harmonies and makes it really contemporary. For younger listeners coming to jazz standards for the first time, Glasper's version is a gateway jug. And I'm recording this on International Jazz Appreciation Day in 2026, and this was recorded on International Jazz Appreciation Day in 2018 in St. Petersburg, Russia. And this is where I leave you. Thanks for taking the time to listen to The Standard Show on Big E Radio. Today's standard was Stella by Starlight, and I'm your host every week, Joanna Lean, and I love bringing these to you. You can go back to past episodes and rehear this episode by going to www.the-standard-show.com, where you can see more versions and performances of the tune, where you can find the real book charts for the tune, and where you can always send me a note to tell me what you'd like to hear next and what you think of what I've done. Thanks so much. Have a great week.
Hey there, music lovers. Did you know that getting licensed to share music online is not just the right thing to do? It's also super important for supporting creators and the music industry. That's why we're proud to be licensed by SOCAN, a copyright collective that grants licenses for online music broadcasts in Canada. By getting licensed through SOCAN, you ensure that every beat, every note, and every melody that you play is compliant and fair to the creators. Join us in supporting the music community. Visit SOCAN's website at www.socan.com and get your web radio, podcast, or any other use of online music licensed today. Let's stream beautiful music together, legally and ethically. SOCAN. Music. People. Connected.